Hey, roll up your pants. Here comes the colonel.
Yeah. Once again, the Senate cavalry comes racing through our studios. Hey, you're in the wrong studio. The Westerns are down the hall. This is a science program. Welcome back to the second half of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network, exploring the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. In just a minute, we're going to get to a very exciting guest. Peter Jenniskens from SETI is still looking for extraterrestrial life and, of course, was taking part of this meteor that came down April 22nd in the morning over California and Nevada, and he's looking for film. Looking for video of anybody who saw this thing come into the atmosphere to get a hold of him, and you'll find out all how to do that here in just a little bit when we get to him. Right now, though, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we have here on the set, reach around at our coin jar a little bit here, and see about the answer to today's query. What do you say?
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help you?
All right, I see we've aroused the spirit of the fountain with the few coins that we've threw in. That, you know, the always greedy spirit of the fountain likes his coins. All right, oh spirit of the fountain, here is today's query. See what you can do with this one. What army was first known as the Christian Mission? Huh? An army, yes, known as the Christian Mission. Which one was it, huh?
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell the others.
Yes, the spirit of the fountain knows all, hears all, sees all, and tells all for a price. The army that was first known as the Christian Mission, if you said the Salvation Army, you're absolutely correct. All right, now back to our guest. Well, what you might know is that a meteorite exploded over California, Nevada at the end of April, and this got scientists pretty excited because they say that it's a very rare carbonaceous chondrite. I'm not sure exactly what that means. We're going to find out in a minute here because we're going to talk to Peter Jenniskens from SETI, who's going to give us an explanation. They scrambled a Zeppelin, what we used to call a blimp here in the United States, to do an aerial view of where the meteorite may have fallen or did fall. They're calling it the Sutter's Mill meteorite. We presume that's probably because it's northeast of Sacramento in the Sutter's Mill area, I suppose. Anyway, we've got Peter on the line here. He's the lead scientist. Peter, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you.
Now, first of all, you're with SETI, S-E-T-I, and we know SETI's background as being the organization that's been looking for extraterrestrial life for a long time, but we haven't heard about SETI in a long time. SETI is still in operation?
Well, SETI also does a lot of studies that have to do with what are your chances that there is life elsewhere, and how does life originate? How does life survive? How does life spread in the universe? And one of the interesting aspects of this fall is that we are dealing with a carbonaceous chondrite of the sort that would have brought the compounds to the Earth that made life on our planet possible.
All right, so you think that this carbonaceous chondrite is the sort of thing that may have fallen on the Earth that made our life as we know it today here on Earth, made that possible. Now, what exactly is a carbonaceous chondrite? Now, carbonaceous, that means it's loaded with carbon, and chondrite means it's a rock? Is that what we're talking about?
It's a rock, and the key thing is loaded with carbon. It also still had some water in it originally, so there's water tied to mineral compounds in the rock. And that really indicates that this rock came together from very volatile, very primitive types of material at the time of the origin of the solar system.
All right, we know that this thing then, this meteorite, breaks down really quick. That's why you had to move so fast on this. But how did you know this meteorite is the very rare carbonaceous chondrite that decomposes so quickly with moisture when it just fell to the Earth there the end of April?
Yes, well, that was discovered very quickly when the first fragments were found. I was there on Tuesday. I think I found myself the second piece that was recovered, very black-looking, very dark. That tells you that there is a lot of carbon in this meteorite. And And so that was extremely exciting. We could also already see that the meteorites were degrading from the weather. They absorb moisture, and the moisture makes things rust, and it changes things. And so it is really important for us to get as much of this material as quickly as possible out of the weather.
All right, so you scrambled this Zeppelin and got with NASA and have been doing a search. I understand it began Thursday, the 3rd of May. Weather held you up just a bit, but what did the Zeppelin find from the air? Did it lead you to some interesting finds?
Well, we don't know yet. The motivation, the reason why we were deploying the Zeppelin was because this asteroid was not just really rare and important to get out of the weather, it was also big. A sonic boom, the sound was created, it was so loud that people felt wind gusts and their houses shake. And from the loudness of the sonic boom, we think that this object was the kilotons of kinetic energy being deposited, and we're talking then about a few meters in size. We don't know exactly how big, maybe 2 meters, 3 meters, but something scale. This is a big rock coming in, a little world, if you like. And so the question is, where is all that material? Did it lose all its material when it traveled through the atmosphere? Did everything evaporate? Or did some big chunks coming down on the ground? Now, if big chunks came down, they are really hard to stop. The atmosphere will slow down the pieces, but smaller ones much easier than the really big ones. So the big ones keep flying further along the trajectory, and they get spread out over an enormous area. So we're basically talking about trying to find kilogram-sized objects over a 30-mile area and then maybe 10 miles wide. It's a huge, huge area to survey. And so by walking or by driving your car in the area, that's not the way to find these species. And so it turns out that we were very fortunate to have an organization work out of NASA Ames called Air Ventures, and they have this wonderful Zeppelin, the perfect platform to do an aerial search of this very large area. So we got a chance to go up in the Zeppelin. We were flying at about 1,000 feet, about 300 meters above the ground. And we were looking for big impact pits. If you have a kilogram of this stuff coming down and it shatters on the ground, it's really still moving with some of the speed of the fiber coming in. They create a big meter-sized dents in the ground, scars, if you like, impact pits. And so we certainly were able to see that sort of structures from a very wide area around. But even in the Zeppelin, we could not cover the whole region in which things could have fallen. So we did our best. We had a camera on board that was able to zoom in on everything we found. We had a system where we had three people spotting the area, looking for features. As soon as something was found, a navigator would try and determine where that was, and an imaging team would then aim the camera and try and zoom in on it. It's the same sort of camera as people use in the TV news from helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were able to look at it, and with that tool, we were able to discard a lot of possibilities. So we were able to say, no, this is something else, this is something else. But we were also trying to fly as big an area as possible, so we couldn't look carefully enough at a number of objects. And so those are still on the list of sites to check out, and just to make certain that nothing is found there. So as of today, the biggest piece that was recovered from this meteorite is still only about 19 grams or so in size, in weight. So it's still very small. But if this thing was as big as we think it is, larger pieces must have fallen.
Well, you say the original meteor, though, was several meters wide. You say what, the size of an automobile or a bus or a freight train? What size was this?
Not quite a bus, but certainly the size of the car was bigger. small calf. And so they basically the size of a human being, a little bit bigger than a human being we're talking about. And so it's a small little world. And that makes it really interesting to try and recover a lot of the material that came down and determine where exactly it landed on the ground. Because all those locations where it is found relate back to where material was inside the original asteroid. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to reconstruct what this little asteroid looked like, what in the world this was. If in the future we ever get to go to an actual asteroid and have a human space mission to an asteroid, it will be fantastic to see all this in context, to see all the rocks sit together and how all the materials relate to each other. So now, the best thing we can do is try and relate that back by looking at where all the various pieces were found.
Are these pieces that you're finding now, this very rare carbonaceous chondrite, does it have molecules in it that would lead you to believe that it came down from extraterrestrial life in space?
We don't think that it brought with it extraterrestrial life. We think that it's because it was created in our solar system. It did not come from other places. It was formed here. But we think it contains compounds that life could have used to get started. For example, people have found amino acids in these meteorites, and that's one of the building blocks that makes life possible. And so, we have many researchers are really keen on looking at this and trying to see if we can learn more by having a fresh fall of this type of meteorite come down.
Now, how do you know that it came from our solar system and not from someplace far away?
Say that again?
How do you know that this meteorite came from our solar system, as you say, and not from some solar system out of our galaxy?
Yeah. All meteorites do. There's been no indication that they come from other places. So it's really the source of the asteroids, the source of this type of meteorites is in our asteroid belt. It's in a region between the planets Mars and Jupiter. There are many asteroids seen there. Thousands, hundreds of thousands of asteroids have now been found to circle the sun around at those places. And occasionally, these asteroids collide with each other, and then they create a debris field of fragments. And it's those pieces that make it to the Earth, and that we see as the meteorite faults we're having. The issue is that we have about 40,000 different meteorites in our collections, and we know of many different meteorite types. But we don't quite know where all these different meteorite types originate in the asteroid belt. What debris field in the asteroid belt corresponds to what particular meteorite type we are having on the Earth. And so a big push at the moment is going to try and identify where do these stones come from in the asteroid belt. Where is the area that delivers all these rocks? Where was there a recent collision that generated all this debris that's coming our way? And so that's very interesting in this case as well. We have a CM dendrite, and we can try and determine where did this particular meteorite originate in the asteroid belt.
All right, so Peter, the best we're going to be able to hope for when you get through looking at all this stuff is that we find amino acids that would allow for the building blocks of life, but no real suggestion that this particular carbonaceous chondrite would have been bringing any life to Earth. It still would have had to have been created in some other way, only with these building blocks. Is that the best we can hope for?
Exactly, yes.
All right, when are you going to know more? You're going to go back to a lab on this thing and release more information when? Next week?
Well, my biggest concern at the moment is that a lot of information on this is perishable, so we really need to get those meteorites out of the weather. So there's a big push going on to try and recover as much material as we can. There's also a lot of information out there that I want to recover, such as video surveillance records, people with video security cameras, mm-hmm. all over California, all over Nevada, may have caused this fireball on Sunday morning, April 22nd, at 7:51, 7:52 a.m. in the morning.
Got it.
They may have video imaging of this. And I really like to recover those. I really like to get the footage of the fireball so I can trace and see on what orbit did this asteroid come in, how did the asteroid break apart when it entered the Earth's atmosphere.
All right, where's all the studies going to be going? I mean, you're going to send this meteorite and the parts you found all back to some university somewhere, I guess, or multiple universities. Who's going to be doing the studies of this?
Yes, we established a consortium called the Set of No Meteorite Consortium. It's basically all researchers interested in studying this material. We are trying to collect as much of it as we can. NASA Ames Research Center is a repository, and from there the meteorites will be distributed to the scientists that are interested in it. And so at the moment the consortium already has quite a number of people from different universities, private institutions, and other government centers that are keen on studying this.
Well, since you have to get moving on this pretty soon before it starts to deteriorate, you've already chosen the universities, I presume. Tell us a few of the universities that that have it right now.
Well, as soon as we get, if we find the meteorite, as soon as we get it, the first thing we do is stabilize the meteorite, make sure that the deterioration is not increasing. That basically means drying out the meteorite, making sure that there's no bacteria growing in it, so stopping bacterial growth, making sure that the material stays clean. And that's something people can do as well. If they find a meteorite, make sure you dry it well, and make sure you basically put it in the freezer as soon as possible to stop any bacterial growth in it. And so there are ways to do this properly. Best thing to do is to take the meteorite, wrap it in aluminum foil, put that in a glass jar, cover the glass jar with aluminum foil, put that in a bigger glass jar with some desiccant in it. And desiccant is basically a material that absorbs water and sort of dries out the air. And desiccant could be as simple as 1 minute rice, for example, that would work. And then seal that lid. If you then dry out the air, then you will dry out the meteorite and you will preserve it. And put that whole thing in the freezer.
Well,
you cool down the after you've dried out the meteorite. Otherwise, you may...
Well, Peter, you know, the thing is once the meteorite has hit the ground, it's got these amino acids in it. I mean, it's got to be contaminated. There's bacteria all over the ground and everything else.
Not immediately, yeah. The amino acids will be fine as long as, indeed, the outside environment doesn't penetrate in. Because remember that when the meteorite comes through the Earth's atmosphere, it creates this glass layer that covers the meteorite. And to a large extent, protects what's inside.
Okay.
And so we are very interested, especially in meteorites that are fully crusted, as it says, that are fully covered by this glass layer.
Oh, that's pretty fascinating. You got a glass layer too, because it goes through the atmosphere. That makes sense to me. Okay, fine. Now then, the Zeppelin, you got that into activity pretty rapidly. Was it useful? I mean, did it find a lot of areas that were singed and where the meteorite had hit?
Yes, it was extremely useful to do this because we really have a good sense now whether something really big could have landed in that area. It was put together really quickly. We apologized to the people that had to cancel their tour that for which the Zeppelin is normally used. To make it available for this science mission, but we are extremely happy that this was possible. And again, it was just a perfect platform. You're slowly drifting 5,000 feet over the ground, just looking at the landscape, and you have such a wide area that you can cover and look at. It's just phenomenal. You really have sort of the view of the meteorites themselves when they came falling down. And just before they hit the ground, you really see the meteorites from the direction in which they were coming.
All right. Well, when we send a mission to an asteroid or a meteor out there in space sometime with a Earth launched vehicle, and we send astronauts up or robots up or something like that to do some analysis, what are we going to find? We're going to find life on an asteroid or the building blocks of life, like amino acids, or are we going to find anything that's going to be dissimilar to what you just found now with this Sutter's Mill meteorite?
Well, that's the very question. What are we going to find? The most exciting possibility is that at the moment we don't know. The best place we can go to is an object that we are really curious about, and that's not that difficult because these falls are so rare. Commissioned conduits to have those on the ground fresh are so rare that every time you find something unexpected, and I'm sure it's going to happen here as well.
All right, that's pretty exciting. One more thing before we go. Bring us up to date on SETI. Are you still recruiting people with computers around the world to listen to radio waves from outer space as you were doing back 10 years ago or so?
The search for artificial radio signals from space is ongoing, and it's very difficult search to do, and the technology really needs to improve, and the techniques for analyzing the data really needs to improve. Hopefully, at some point it will be at the quality that it needs to be.
All right, so in short, we still can't say unequivocally with evidence that there is life beyond this planet, but we still are pretty sure that it's probably out there somewhere. Is that right?
We are searching.
Okay. Peter Jenniskens, very, very, very good of you to be with us today, and good luck. I know you have other reporters you have to talk to, but thank you so much for calling us, and we really appreciate your being along.
It's a pleasure.
All right, before we get to the Voice of Reason, we want to remind you that this award-winning program has been non-commercial since 2010 and wholly supported by independent interests in the emerging science community and contributions from listeners like you. It is your support that keeps public programs like this one on the air. Donations are gratefully accepted at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On behalf of the staff and management here at the Science News Radio Network, our deepest gratitude to those of you who've contributed. Thank you.
And now, we make time for the Voice of Reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
I hope people start to understand is when they sit down to their computer, they should not start off in a position of assuming it's secure. When you log into your computer in the morning at work, your default position for most people is, this is a secure device and I trust it. And I think we need to get people to stop thinking that way so they will start using encrypted email. That would take care of a lot of problems. So they would check their antivirus to make sure it was recently updated because you don't trust the computer. They may, if something's odd, they'll call a security professional and get some advice rather than just thinking, oh, something else is weird, My hard drive keeps spinning up when I'm not on it and you can see the computer's active. You may need somebody with some forensic skills to tell you where to go to look to see if you have a problem or if it's just auto-patching. So, really, I think a lot of our issues, if people started, applying some education, some training, and some discipline to understand the security aspects and the risks they're taking. So by educating people on those basic kind of risks, you should have a firewall, you should have an antivirus, you should have backed up your equipment. Those kind of basic steps will really increase security across the entire Internet. So my name is Steve Winterfeld. I'm the co-author with Jason Andres of the book called Cyber Warfare, Techniques, Tactics, and Tools for Security Practitioners.
So you decide, has this really been the Voice of Reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.